Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in Washington, D.C.
And in Delray Beach, Florida, I'm Ken Rudin.
Ken, listen, I don't know if you've heard about this being on the road.
Yeah.
But Newt Gingrich won the South Carolina primary last Saturday.
He won it overwhelmingly, 40-28%. He carried 43 out of 46 counties. It was a huge, huge victory. Now, again, we're thinking, well, was this a big defeat for Mitt Romney? Well,
yes.
Was Mitt Romney supposed to win South Carolina?
Yes.
Probably. Well, you think so?
Yes, because he was the front runner.
Well, right.
And South Carolina has made its reputation as picking the Republican nominee largely by voting for the front runner. They have gone for the guy who won New Hampshire or Iowa, usually New Hampshire, and they have never voted for somebody who finished fourth or no better than fourth in Iowa and New Hampshire. They just don't pick people from back in the pack.
Right, and Newt Gingrich finished fourth in both, as you say, both in Iowa and New Hampshire. But something in between New Hampshire and South Carolina occurred, and that's the debate where basically it seemed like Newt Gingrich knocked Mitt Romney off his perch. And as we've seen many times in these debates, Newt Gingrich gave an outstanding performance.
Now, was that a function of Newt Gingrich giving an outstanding performance and Mitt Romney not giving a very good performance? Or was it largely a function of the audience reaction in the hall that created this impression in the minds, I think, of South Carolinians generally, that this was the popular champion, the second coming of Ronald Reagan, that on both the two debate nights before the South Carolina primary got this huge audience reaction?
Well, I love the fact that Newt Gingrich is calling himself the second coming of Ronald Reagan because, as we do know, in the debate so far, Newt Gingrich has mentioned Ronald Reagan 7,512 times, and Ronald Reagan mentioned Newt Gingrich in his memoirs once.
Yeah, that was Mitt Romney's line, and probably a pretty good shot.
But I think there's fairness to it. I mean, it's just remarkable how Newt Gingrich has become the Reagan conservative here when, by all indications, he was not a true conservative. There were a lot of conservatives in the House who felt that he was too willing to accommodate the moderates or even the Democrats, which you don't always expect when you think of Newt Gingrich. But, I mean, a true conservative, you know, I don't know if Newt Gingrich fits the bill, but if you listen to the debates, he certainly does.
That's a theme that's been sounded, too, by some of Ronald Reagan's own, former administration members, people like Elliot Abrams, who has written some very tough stuff about Newt Gingrich. In fact, saying that during the Reagan years, when he was a congressman, Newt Gingrich was often dismissive of Ronald Reagan and didn't show him much intellectual respect and was even insulting of Ronald Reagan.
And especially with the second debate in South Carolina, when John King, CNN's John King, asked that famous question about Marianne Gingrich and the open marriage. I mean, Newt Gingrich knew it was coming. It was a softball, and he hit it out of the park. And, of course, he also had the advantage of having an audience that just, you know, cheered him on as if it was like a gladiator match.
That's
and
right.
I think in many ways these debates have become gladiator matches. The thought of Lincoln Douglas, let alone Kennedy Nixon or Ford Carter, with audiences hooting and hollering, it just doesn't sound like anything we've ever thought of before, let alone had an influence like it does now.
Well, unlike you, Ken, I don't actually have any personal memories of Lincoln Douglas, but I understand that there might have been a certain amount of raucous reaction even then in Illinois.
That's correct. It certainly was.
There was a noted change in the environment and, if you will, the temperature of the room when they got to Florida in the first debate this week. And we suddenly saw Mitt Romney seem a lot more comfortable. We saw Newt Gingrich perhaps seem a little less as though he were being borne on the shoulders of his angry countrymen. And we went back to a more standard kind of debate. It was duller. And Romney got some shots in and Gingrich got some shots in. And maybe in some sense or another, that staunched the bleeding for Mitt Romney, at least for the moment.
Perhaps, and we did see, I think Mitt Romney realized that if the only questions he was going to get were about his tax returns, then by announcing in advance of the debate that he was going to release them the day after the debate, of course the day of the State of the Union message, Romney, one, took that issue off the table, and two, was able to go back to the argument he's been trying to say that Newt Gingrich is an irresponsible and unreliable conservative, and talking about the things that Newt Gingrich is vulnerable about, notably his contract with Freddie Mac.
Now, and the way that Newt Gingrich has represented that contract saying that it strictly forbade him doing any lobbying. Now, we saw two contracts released by the Gingrich campaign this week.
Which were kind of boilerplate, no?
Yes. I mean, in one case, it didn't say that he couldn't lobby. And in the other case, it did say that. But then it proceeded to describe a lot of activities that sounded an awful lot like exactly what lobbyists do, and also to specify that he would be reporting to Freddie Mac's chief lobbyist.
Which is what all historians do, right?
Yes. Historians historically report to the chief lobbyist.
Right.
But here's the thing. Here we are 2 or 3 days past that first debate in Florida. We're recording this on Thursday before the ultimate Florida debate, which will be the last one before the vote on the 31st in Jacksonville. But at this moment, what seems to be the dominant energy is not so much Mitt Romney's attacks on Newt Gingrich or Newt Gingrich's portrayal of Mitt Romney as, you know, this guy whose tax returns show he makes $20 million a year for no work, as Newt Gingrich keeps saying. Not a very Republican thing to say.
Not at all.
But at any rate, it's not so much what Mitt is saying about Newt or Newt about Mitt. It's more what people are saying about Newt. The National Review, the Weekly Standard, Ann Coulter, all these people coming out of the woodwork throughout, really, the conservative media. I can't really think of an exception. Just absolutely ruling Newt Gingrich out, reading him out of the party, saying that he's a vote for him is a vote for Obama, Ann Coulter said. What's going on here?
Well, a lot of it is, look, we always talk about how the establishment Republicans, whatever that means, have lined up behind Mitt Romney. And aside from the exit polls in South Carolina, all polls have indicated that if any Republican is going to be President Obama in November, it's Mitt Romney. And the South Carolina's polls did not show that. And if you take a look at what's happened since those debates, not only is Newt Gingrich's numbers not improving, but Mitt Romney's numbers are coming down as well. His approval numbers are declining pretty rapidly. His numbers among independents are declining pretty rapidly. And if the Republican Party does sense that Mitt Romney is the guy who's going to carry them into the battle against Obama in November, then to have these kind of debates that Newt Gingrich is savaging him, it's really destroying the only opportunity in many people's minds of them beating Obama in the general election.
So is it a calculation on the part of all of these conservative commentators and thinkers that they're better off with Mitt, therefore they better trash Newt? Or do they have some real animus with regard to Newt Gingrich himself?
Well, I think your latter point is a very good point. I think there's a lot of animosity regarding Newt Gingrich that's been festering for decades. But at the same time, they just know that the longer this goes on, the more disadvantaged it is for their party to win in November. But there's never been a love fest for Newt Gingrich. A lot of the conservatives who were swept into office, into the majority with Gingrich in 1994, turned on him during his 4 years. Mitt Romney made a very good point that Newt Gingrich didn't leave after the 1998 elections on his own accord because he just felt they didn't win as many seats as they should have. They had a net loss in 1998. But the fact is he was drummed out by most of his own party. He talked about the reprimand of the House.
That's
now, of
right.
course, Mitt Romney did say that no other Speaker of the House resigned before, and I guess he forgot about Jim Wright. But aside from that, I mean, Newt Gingrich was pretty much in disgrace when he left in 1998. His whole party had repudiated him, and that reputation has not been enhanced by this presidential campaign.
That's right. He was clearly deflated as a figure in the Republican Party at the time, and he has spent the subsequent 13 years primarily doing this activity, which he calls being a historian, and which most other people look at and say, that walks like a lobbyist.
Yeah.
So that's really where we are with Newt right now, except that in these debates, by going after the media, and he started that in the very first debate, way back last spring, he started going after the media. He said when he was asked, some kind of a question about who on this stage would do what, he says, I'm going to resist every attempt that you make, you the media, you the moderator, you the questioners, to set good Republicans against each other on this stage. We're going to all resist that. And that was his theme throughout something like 17, 18 debates that we've had now.
And that's when he rose in the polls, by saying that I'm not going to trash another Republican, you know, the famous 11th commandment. The object of our scorn should be Obama and not fellow Republicans.
Now, of course, the gloves are off with respect to Mitt Romney for obvious reasons. And he's also thrown a couple of punches in the direction of Rick Santorum and Ron Paul, who each seem to be getting something like 10% in Florida. But let's talk about Florida. Let's talk about the particulars of this, the first mega state to hold a primary coming up on Tuesday. This is our last podcast before that. And what's different about Florida? We've got registered Republicans only voting. Is that going to make a big difference?
Well, there's a lot of things that are different. Yes, it's a closed primary. I'm independent, and there can be no crossovers from independents or Democrats. Two, it's a huge state with multi markets, major
markets, 10 media markets.
Exactly. I mean, Miami and the I-4 corridor between Daytona, Orlando, and Tampa, and then you have Jacksonville up north. It's a really a huge state where organization and money usually make a big difference. And the question has always been, this week at least, is that, is the organization and money going to prove superior as it always has in the past? Or is there a sense of momentum of Newt Gingrich's victory in South Carolina that's going to help him here? Now, there are some new polls that seem to indicate that a little slowing of the Gingrich juggernaut. Matter of fact, there's one poll that came out late this week that had Romney opening up a lead.
Well, one thing that makes Florida different is you've got a large Hispanic population, large Spanish-speaking population, and many of them are Cuban, and that has always been a particular political community.
And two of the Cuban community's most favorite Republicans are Marco Rubio, the senator first elected in 2010, and Jeb Bush, the former governor. Now, both are
neutral.
Ostensibly not backing any candidate. They're not, you know, they're completely neutral in this primary. But I noticed that Marco Rubio this past week basically reprimanded the Gingrich campaign for, one, running unfair attacks against Mitt Romney, and twice Gingrich had to back down.
Yeah, that's going to make it harder for these people to appear neutral.
But it's interesting, you know, we always talk about how this has been a race of the establishment versus the Gingrich slash Santorum anti-establishment. But if you go to Florida in 2010, it was the anti-establishment candidate, Rick Scott, who defeated the establishment candidate, Bill McCollum, in the Republican primary, went on to win the governorship.
That's right. And Rick Scott has been noticeably unnoticeable thus far in this primary. He doesn't seem to have either chosen a preference or really even appeared in the context of this whole struggle.
And Bill McCollum, who had been the establishment candidate for governor and senator for all the other offices he's run for and lost, he's a big Gingrich supporter.
Well, and he was a Gingrich guy back in the 90s. He was part of the Gingrich regime back in the impeachment era. But a lot of the other people who were, including Tom DeLay, have come out against Gingrich this fall. So Bill McCollum's a bit of an outlier in that respect.
Now, we're not talking too much about Rick Santorum or Ron Paul. Ron Paul seems to have made a conscious effort to skip Florida, one, because it's a closed primary, two, because it's a winner-take-all primary, which, of course, that's one of the reasons Florida is being penalized for half its delegation.
Yeah, it's only getting 50 delegates instead of
100. They're only getting 50, right,
yeah.
Instead of 99. But Ron Paul seems to be very happy to go on to upcoming caucus states where, of course, there is proportional representation and where he can pick up a number of delegates.
So it's a bit of a waste of time, really, for either Santorum or for Ron Paul to spend a lot of time in Florida.
Yes, that's true, except you know that Ron Paul is going to be in it to the end. He's not going to go away anytime soon. He'll probably be there well into the April, May, and even June primaries. I can't say the same thing about Rick Santorum.
That's right. But, of course, they both get to be in both of the debates, so they do get that national exposure as well. And that helps them probably hold on to their whatever, 10% or what have you, in the Florida contest.
And I think there was another guy who made a big campaign speech this week, the guy who's running on the Democratic line.
He does seem to be running this year, and he laid out what many people consider to be the frame of his campaign. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
Now, you can call this class warfare all you want, but asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes? Most Americans would call that common sense.
And you know, what was very effective, I thought, for President Obama is that without mentioning his name, when he talks about income inequality and paying your fair share, he didn't have to mention Mitt Romney.
20 million. 14%. Sorry. Well, he might have been talking about Mitt Romney, who made more than $20 million in each of the last two tax years and paid something south of 15%.
Exactly. I mean, he didn't have to mention Mitt Romney's name, but by just talking about the income and inequality and the people that should be paying at least 30% of their, you know, taxes.
Over a million.
Of their income.
Over a million. Yeah. You send 30% to the federal government. Does that seem fair to you, Ken? I mean, in your own personal case.
Well, I mean, between my trips, you know, for NPR and my speech engagements and all that thing, I'm making well into the four figures.
Are you counting the decimal point there? All right. A lot of people thought maybe the president went a little too far in the campaign direction because, after all, he does have another year on this term. And maybe he should be laying out a program that this Congress that's already there, Republican House, Democratic Senate in theory, they could possibly pass and it could do some good for people this year, maybe help people get jobs, help the economy, that sort of thing?
I think in previous States of the Union addresses, you would obviously have a president exhorting or suggesting that Congress pass legislation. President Obama knows that Congress is not going to do any major stuff this year. I mean, to say it's because of the campaign and the upcoming election is kind of silly because nothing is getting done anyway. And so rather than talk to Congress, he obviously talks over the head of Congress, talks to the people and saying, look, I'm going to be doing these things. And if the Congress is not going to get its act together, then I'm not going to wait for Congress. I'm going to do stuff on my own, such as recess appointments, executive actions, things like that. And of course, that drives the Republicans nuts, but that's the nature of the game with, you know, just a couple of months to go before the election.
Understood. Now, speaking of unilateral action, Ken, what did you think of the Mitch Daniels rebuttal?
Well, you know, look, Mitch Daniels laid out the arguments against President Obama, and it was a very, I thought, a good speech, an effective speech. He didn't miss anything. I noticed he also talked about the Keystone Pipeline, which I think the president conveniently did not mention during the State of the Union message. But also at the same time, look, I think ultimately, as everybody knows, these are pre-buttals. These speeches, these ostensible responses to the president, State of the Union addresses, are written before the president gives his address. So it's really hard to say that this is a good response to the president, but is it a good argument for the Republicans and their opposition to the president? Yes, but ultimately, look, I don't think anybody will remember, let alone Mitch Daniels, they won't remember Barack Obama's State of the Union. There's a lot more campaigning to come, and of course, we'll see the debates in the fall where the separation between the two candidates really come into play.
And you also have him, in terms of that contrast dynamic to the Republicans, very coolly coming in and saying to Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, good job tonight, wink, good job tonight. We're all speculating, whoa, where did the drone hit tonight? You know, what do we not know about? Who else did we go after? Turns out that the same Navy SEALs team that got Osama bin Laden went out and freed a couple of hostages in Somalia, and the president didn't make a huge deal, but didn't talk about it in the State of the Union, didn't talk about it a lot the next day, just a little statement. But there is this contrast that he is laying out. Certainly this is the Democratic viewpoint on it, that he's laying out a contrast between doer, somebody who is incrementally making things better, showing toughness to the world, and, well, you just watch what's going on down there in Florida and tell us if you think that looks preferable.
And you know, as the economy improves and there are foreign policy successes he can take credit for, the president can take credit for, his numbers will invariably inch up at the same time while, you know, the Republican numbers are moving down. And so right now, you know, I would say that coming at the end of January, the president's odds for reelection, who knows what's going to happen in November, but they certainly seem to be improved over the last month or so.
One thing I think people will remember from that night of the State of the Union speech and from the day after was the farewell to Gabby Giffords. Gabby Giffords came to the floor. She was greeted by the president, who came, gave her a hug, and she was on the floor there while her husband, Mark Kelly, sat in the First Lady's box in the gallery above the House floor. It was a highly emotional moment. Many, many people wanted to come and give their best wishes to Gabby Giffords. As she returned to the floor, for the second time, but really the first extended period of time since her gunshot wound of a year ago, from which she is still recovering.
Clearly the most emotional moment of the evening. It just reminds us how heartbreaking that whole situation is, that she resigned from Congress effective Wednesday to work on her recovery. And this resignation comes in with days of the news that Senator Mark Kirk, the freshman Republican from Illinois, also suffered a stroke over the weekend, that he's perhaps doing better than expected, but they're talking about he'll never be physically 100%. And it's just tragic to watch. And, of course, all talks about who the Democratic governor of Illinois might appoint to succeed Mark Kirk if he can't continue is premature. First of all, the last thing the Democrats in Illinois want is another Rod Blagojevich situation where there's an open Senate seat. But there's a long way for a physical recovery, and it's just sad to watch.
And this, of course, for a senator who is in his early 50s, as I understand.
52 years old, right.
52 years old. Now, one other piece of Senate news. New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez has a new challenger as he faces re-election this fall.
Well, this is a fascinating race because, first of all, you know, no Republican has won in New Jersey since 1972. That was, of course, Clifford Case.
I remember Clifford.
That's right. And the Republicans, you know, are dying to win a Senate race there. They have not won in all this time. And the guy they've come up with, the Joseph Carrillos, who's a state senator from Monmouth County, what's fascinating about him, he's very, very close to Governor Chris Christie. Chris Christie, as you well remember, when he was U.S. attorney, opened up an investigation, an ethics investigation, on Bob Menendez years ago before he was governor. So there's tremendous bad blood between Menendez and Christie. And obviously, even though Joseph Carilles is probably going to be the Republican nominee for the Senate, this will obviously be Christie versus...
It's a surrogate race.
Exactly. And obviously one to watch. And we didn't expect New Jersey would be one of the states that you have to watch in November.
One other piece of congressional election news. Dozens of incumbents from both parties are retiring this year. The House does not look like a very attractive place to remain. But one person who has announced she will remain, or at least try to remain and run for re-election, is Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota.
There was a lot of question about that when she finished a disappointing last place finish in Iowa. There was a lot of questions about whether she wanted to come back to the House, whether she maybe get a contract with Fox, go on to some speaking engagements. But she says, no, I'm coming back and I'm going to be a very effective fighter for Tea Party and conservative causes. And there are a lot of conservatives who are very pleased that she's going to return, hopefully, to run for a fourth term in Congress.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
In Washington, D.C., I'm Ron Elving.
And in Delray Beach, Florida, I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week when we'll know what happened in Florida on It's All Politics from NPR.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through.
And they'll endure should time allow. I seem to always feel him near somehow.